benefited and on what terms he is acting, in order that we may accept the benefit on these terms, or else decline it. It is disputable whether we ought to measure a service by its utility to the receiver and make the return with a view to that, or by the benevolence of the giver. For those who have received say they have received from their benefactors what meant little to the latter and what they might have got from others, minimizing the service, while the givers, on the contrary, say it was the biggest thing they had, and what could not have been got from others, and that it was given in times of danger or similar need. Now, if the friendship is one that aims at utility, surely the advantage to the receiver is the measure. For it is he that asks for the service, and the other man helps him on the assumption that he will receive the equivalent. So the assistance has been precisely as great as the advantage to the receiver, and therefore he must return as much as he has received or even more, for that would be nobler. In friendships based on virtue, on the other hand, complaints do not arise, but the purpose of the doer is a sort of measure, for in purpose lies the essential element of virtue and character. 14. Differences arise also in friendships based on superiority, for each expects to get more out of them. But when this happens, the friendship is dissolved. Not only does the better man think he ought to get more, since more should be assigned to a good man, but the more useful similarly expects this. They say a useless man should not get as much as they should, since it becomes an act of public service and not a friendship if the proceeds of the friendship do not answer to the worth of the benefits conferred. For they think that, as in a commercial partnership, those who put more in get more out, so it should be in friendship. But the man who is in a state of need and inferiority makes the opposite claim. They think it is the part of a good friend to help those who are in need. What, they say, is the use of being the friend of a good man or a powerful man if one is to get nothing out of it? At all events, it seems that each party is justified in his claim, and that each should get more out of the friendship than the other, not more of the same thing, however, but the superior more honour, and the inferior more gain. For honour is the prize of virtue and of beneficence, while gain is the assistance required by inferiority. It seems to be so in constitutional arrangements also. The man who contributes nothing good to the common stock is not honoured, for what belongs to the public is given to the man who benefits the public, and honour does belong to the public. It is not possible to get wealth from the common stock and at the same time honour, for no one puts up with the smaller share in all things. Therefore, to the man who loses in wealth they assign honour, and to the man who is willing to be paid, wealth, since the proportion to merit equalizes the parties and preserves the friendship, as we have said. This, then, is also the way in which we should associate with unequals. The man who is benefited in respect of wealth or virtue must give honour in return, paying what he can. For friendship asks a man to do what he can, not what is proportional to the merits of the case, since that cannot always be done, e.g. in honours paid to the gods or to parents. For no one could ever return to them the equivalent of what he gets. But the man who serves them to the utmost of his power is thought to be a good man. This is why it would not seem open to a man to disown his father, though a father may disown his son, being in debt, he should repay. But there is nothing by doing which a son will have done the equivalent of what he has received, so that he is always in debt. But creditors can remit a debt, and a father can therefore do so too. At the same time, it is thought that presumably no one would repudiate a son who was not far gone in wickedness, For apart from the natural friendship of a father and son, it is human nature not to reject a son's assistance. But the son, if he is wicked, will naturally avoid aiding his father or not be zealous about it. For most people wish to get benefits, but avoid doing them as a thing unprofitable. So much for these questions. Book 9. 1. In all friendships between dissimilars, it is, as we have said, proportion that equalizes the parties and preserves the friendship. E.g., in the political form of friendship, the shoemaker gets a return for his shoes in proportion to his worth, and the weaver and all other craftsmen do the same. Now here, a common measure has been provided in the form of money, and therefore everything is referred to this and measured by this. But in the friendship of lovers, sometimes the lover complains that his excess of love is not met by love in return, though perhaps there is nothing lovable about him. While often the beloved complains that the lover who formerly promised everything now performs nothing. Such incidents happen when the lover loves the beloved for the sake of pleasure, while the beloved loves the lover for the sake of utility. And they do not both possess the qualities expected of them. If these be the objects of the friendship, it is dissolved when they do not get the things that formed the motives of their love, for each did not love the other person himself, but the qualities he had, and these were not enduring. That is why the friendships also are transient. But the love of characters, as has been said, endures because it is self-dependent. Differences arise when what they get is something different and not what they desire, for it is like getting nothing at all when we do not get what we aim at. Compare the story of the person who made promises to a lyre player, promising him the more the better he sang. But in the morning, when the other demanded the fulfilment of his promises, said that he had given pleasure for pleasure. Now, if this had been what each wanted, all would have been well. But if the one wanted enjoyment, but the other gain, and the one has what he wants while the other has not, the terms of the association will not have been properly fulfilled, for what each in fact wants is what he attends to. And it is for the sake of that, that he will give what he has. But who is to fix the worth of the service? He who makes the sacrifice, or he who has got the advantage? At any rate, the other seems to leave it to him. This is what they say Protagoras used to do. Whenever he taught anything whatsoever, he bade the learner assess the value of the knowledge and accepted the amount so fixed. But in such matters, some men approve of the saying, "Let a man have his fixed reward." Those who get the money first and then do none of the things they said they would, owing to the extravagance of their promises, naturally find themselves the objects of complaint, for they do not fulfill what they agreed to. The sophists are perhaps compelled to do this because no one would give money for the things they do know. These people, then, if they do not do what they have been paid for, are naturally made the objects of complaint. But where there is no contract of service, those who give up something for the sake of the other party cannot, as we have said, be complained of, for that is the nature of the friendship of virtue. And the return to them must be made on the basis of their purpose. For it is purpose that is the characteristic thing in a friend and in virtue. And so too, it seems, should one make a return to those with whom one has studied philosophy, for their worth cannot be measured against money, and they can get no honour which will balance their services, but still it is perhaps enough, as it is with the gods and with one's parents, to give them what one can. If the gift was not of this sort, but was made with a view to a return, it is no doubt preferable that the return made should be one that seems fair to both parties. But if this cannot be achieved, It would seem not only necessary that the person who gets the first service should fix the reward, but also just. For if the other gets in return the equivalent of the advantage the beneficiary has received, or the price he would have paid for the pleasure, he will have got what is fair as from the other. We see this happening too with things put up for sale. And in some places, there are laws providing that no actions shall arise out of voluntary contracts, on the assumption that one should settle with a person to whom one has given credit, in the spirit in which one has bargained with him. The law holds that it is more just that the person to whom credit was given should fix the terms than that the person who gave credit should do so. For most things are not assessed at the same value by those who have them and those who want them. Each class values highly what is its own and what it is offering, yet the return is made on the terms fixed by the receiver. But no doubt the receiver should assess a thing not at what it seems worth when he has it, but at what he assessed it at before he had it. 2. A further problem is set by such questions as whether one should in all things give the preference to one's father and obey him, or whether when one is ill one should trust a doctor, and when one has to elect a general should elect a man of military skill, and similarly, whether one should render a service by preference to a friend or to a good man, and should show gratitude to a benefactor or oblige a friend, if one cannot do both. All such questions are hard, are they not, to decide with precision? For they admit of many variations of all sorts in respect both of the magnitude of the service and of its nobility necessity. But that we should not give the preference in all things to the same person is plain enough, and we must, for the most part, return benefits rather than oblige friends, as we must pay back a loan to a creditor rather than make one to a friend. But perhaps even this is not always true. E.g., should a man who has been ransomed out of the hands of brigands ransom his ransomer in return, whoever he may be, or pay him, if he has not been captured but demands payment, or should he ransom his father? It would seem that he should ransom his father in preference even to himself. As we have said, then, generally the debt should be paid. But if the gift is exceedingly noble or exceedingly necessary, one should defer to these considerations. For sometimes, it is not even fair to return the equivalent of what one has received when the one man has done a service to one whom he knows to be good, while the other makes a return to one whom he believes to be bad. For that matter, one should sometimes not lend in return to one who has lent to oneself. For the one person lent to a good man expecting to recover his loan, while the other has no hope of recovering from one who is believed to be bad. Therefore, if the facts really are so, the demand is not fair. And if they are not, but people think they are, they would be held to be doing nothing strange in refusing. As we have often pointed out, then, discussions about feelings and actions have just as much definiteness as their subject matter. That we should not make the same return to everyone, nor give a father the preference in everything, as one does not sacrifice everything to Zeus, is plain enough. But since we ought to render different things to parents, brothers, comrades, and benefactors, we ought to render to each class what is appropriate and becoming. And this is what people seem in fact to do. To marriages they invite their kinsfolk, for these have a part in the family and therefore in the doings that affect the family, and at funerals also they think that kinsfolk before all others should meet for the same reason. And it would be thought that in the matter of food we should help our parents before all others, since we owe our own nourishment to them. And it is more honourable to help in this respect the authors of our being even before ourselves, and honour too one should give to one's parents as one does to the gods. But not any and every honour. For that matter, One should not give the same honour to one's father and one's mother, nor, again, should one give them the honour due to a philosopher or to a general, but the honour due to a father or, again, to a mother. To all older persons, too, one should give honour appropriate to their age, by rising to receive them and finding seats for them and so on, while to comrades and brothers one should allow freedom of speech and common use of all things, to kinsmen, too, and fellow tribesmen and fellow citizens, and to every other class, one should always try to assign what is appropriate, and to compare the claims of each class with respect to nearness of relation and to virtue or usefulness. The comparison is easier when the persons belong to the same class, and more laborious when they are different. Yet we must not, on that account, shrink from the task, but decide the question as best we can. 3. Another question that arises is whether friendships should or should not be broken off when the other party does not remain the same. Perhaps we may say that there is nothing strange in breaking off a friendship based on utility or pleasure when our friends no longer have these attributes. For it was of these attributes that we were the friends, and when these have failed it is reasonable to love no longer. But one might complain of another if, when he loved us for our usefulness or pleasantness, he pretended to love us for our character. For as we said at the outset, most differences arise between friends when they are not friends in the spirit in which they think they are. So when a man has deceived himself and has thought he was being loved for his character, when the other person was doing nothing of the kind, he must blame himself. When he has been deceived by the pretenses of the other person, it is just that he should complain against his deceiver. He will complain with more justice than one does against people who counterfeit the currency, inasmuch as the wrongdoing is concerned with something more valuable. But if one accepts another man as good, and he turns out badly, and is seen to do so, must one still love him? Surely it is impossible, since not everything can be loved, but only what is good. What is evil neither can nor should be loved, for it is not one's duty to be a lover of evil, nor to become like what is bad. And we have said that like is dear like. Must the friendship, then, be forthwith broken off? Or is this not so in all cases, but only when one's friends are incurable in their wickedness? If they are capable of being reformed, one should rather come to the assistance of their character or their property, inasmuch as this is better and more characteristic of friendship. But a man who breaks off such a friendship would seem to be doing nothing strange, for it was not to a man of this sort that he was a friend. When his friend has changed, therefore, and he is unable to save him, he gives him up. But if one friend remained the same while the other became better and far outstripped him in virtue, should the latter treat the former as a friend? Surely he cannot. When the interval is great, this becomes most plain, e.g. in the case of childish friendships. If one friend remained a child in intellect while the other became a fully developed man, how could they be friends when they neither approved of the same things nor delighted in and were pained by the same things? For not even with regard to each other will their tastes agree, and without this, as we saw, they cannot be friends, for they cannot live together. But we have discussed these matters. Should he, then, behave no otherwise towards him than he would if he had never been his friend? Surely he should keep a remembrance of their former intimacy, and as we think we ought to oblige friends rather than strangers, so to those who have been our friends we ought to make some allowance for our former friendship, when the breach has not been due to excess of wickedness. 4. Friendly relations with one's neighbours, and the marks by which friendships are defined, seem to have proceeded from a man's relations to himself. For, first, we define a friend as one who wishes and does what is good, or seems so, for the sake of his friend, or, second, as one who wishes his friend to exist and live for his sake, which mothers do to their children, and friends do who have come into conflict. And, third, others define him as one who lives with and, fourth, has the same tastes as another, or, fifth, one who grieves and rejoices with his friend. And this, too, is found in mothers most of all. It is by some one of these characteristics that friendship, too, is defined. Now, each of these is true of the good man's relation to himself, and of all other men insofar as they think themselves good. Virtue and the good man seem, as has been said, to be the measure of every class of things. For his opinions are harmonious, and he desires the same things with all his soul, and therefore he wishes for himself what is good and what seems so, and does it, for it is characteristic of the good man to work out the good, and does so for his own sake, for he does it for the sake of the intellectual element in him, which is thought to be the man himself, and he wishes himself to live and be preserved, and especially the element by virtue of which he thinks. For existence is good to the virtuous man, and each man wishes himself what is good, while no one chooses to possess the whole world if he has first to become someone else. For that matter, even now God possesses the good. He wishes for this only on condition of being whatever he is, and the element that thinks would seem to be the individual man, or to be so more than any other element in him. And such a man wishes to live with himself, for he does so with pleasure, since the memories of his past acts are delightful, and his hopes for the future are good, and, therefore, pleasant. His mind is well stored, too, with subjects of contemplation, and he grieves and rejoices more than any other with himself, for the same thing is always painful, and the same thing always pleasant, and not one thing at one time and another at another, he has, so to speak, nothing to repent of. Therefore, since each of these characteristics belongs to the good man in relation to himself, and he is related to his friend as to himself, for his friend is another self, friendship too is thought to be one of these attributes, and those who have these attributes to be friends. Whether there is or is not friendship between a man and himself is a question we may dismiss for the present. There would seem to be friendship insofar as he is two or more, to judge from the aforementioned attributes of friendship, and from the fact that the extreme of friendship is likened to one's love for oneself. But the attributes named seem to belong even to the majority of men, poor creatures though they may be. Are we to say, then, that in so far as they are satisfied with themselves and think they are good, they share in these attributes? Certainly no one who is thoroughly bad and impious has these attributes or even seems to do so. They hardly belong even to inferior people, for they are at variance with themselves and have appetites for some things and rational desires for others. This is true, for instance, of incontinent people, for they choose, instead of the things they themselves think good, things that are pleasant but hurtful, while others again, through cowardice and laziness, shrink from doing what they think best for themselves. And those who have done many terrible deeds and are hated for their wickedness even shrink from life and destroy themselves. And wicked men seek for people with whom to spend their days and shun themselves, for they remember many a grievous deed and anticipate others like them when they are by themselves. But when they are with others, they forget, and having nothing lovable in them, they have no feeling of love to themselves. Therefore also such men do not rejoice or grieve with themselves, for their soul is rent by faction, and one element in it by reason of its wickedness grieves when it abstains from certain acts, while the other part is pleased, and one draws them this way and the other that, as if they were pulling them in pieces. If a man cannot at the same time be pained and pleased, at all events, after a short time he is pained because he was pleased, and he could have wished that these things had not been pleasant to him, for bad men are laden with repentance. Therefore the bad man does not seem to be amicably disposed even to himself, because there is nothing in him to love. So that if to be thus is the height of wretchedness, we should strain every nerve to avoid wickedness, and should endeavour to be good. For so and only so can one be either friendly to oneself, or a friend to another. 5. Goodwill is a friendly sort of relation, but is not identical with friendship. For one may have goodwill both towards people whom one does not know, and without their knowing it, but not friendship. This indeed has been said already, but goodwill is not even friendly feeling, for it does not involve intensity or desire, whereas these accompany friendly feeling, and friendly feeling implies intimacy, while goodwill may arise of a sudden, as it does towards competitors in a contest. We come to feel goodwill for them and to share in their wishes, but we would not do anything with them, for, as we said, we feel goodwill suddenly, and love them only superficially. Goodwill seems, then, to be a beginning of friendship, as the pleasure of the eye is the beginning of love, for no one loves if he has not first been delighted by the form of the beloved. But he who delights in the form of another does not, for all that, love him, but only does so when he also longs for him when absent and craves for his presence. So, too, it is not possible for people to be friends if they have not come to feel goodwill for each other, but those who feel goodwill are not for all that friends, for they only wish well to those for whom they feel goodwill, and would not do anything with them, nor take trouble for them. And so one might, by an extension of the term friendship, say that goodwill is inactive friendship, though when it is prolonged and reaches the point of intimacy, it becomes friendship, not the friendship based on utility, nor that based on pleasure, for goodwill too does not arise on those terms. The man who has received a benefit bestows goodwill in return for what has been done to him, but in doing so is only doing what is just. While he who wishes someone to prosper because he hopes for enrichment through him seems to have goodwill not to him but rather to himself. Just as a man is not a friend to another if he cherishes him for the sake of some use to be made of him. In general, goodwill arises on account of some excellence and worth, when one man seems to another beautiful or brave or something of the sort, as we pointed out in the case of competitors in a contest. 6. Unanimity also seems to be a friendly relation. For this reason, it is not identity of opinion, for that might occur even with people who do not know each other, nor do we say that people who have the same views on any and every subject are unanimous, e.g. those who agree about the heavenly bodies, for unanimity about these is not a friendly relation. But we do say that a city is unanimous when men have the same opinion about what is to their interest, and choose the same actions, and do what they have resolved in common. It is about things to be done, therefore, that people are said to be unanimous. And among these, about matters of consequence, and in which it is possible for both or all parties to get what they want, e.g., a city is unanimous when all its citizens think that the offices in it should be elective, or that they should form an alliance with Sparta, or that Pittacus should be their ruler, at a time when he himself was also willing to rule. But when each of two people wishes himself to have the thing in question, like the captains in the Phoenici, they are in a state of faction, for it is not unanimity when each of two parties thinks of the same thing, whatever that may be, but only when they think of the same thing in the same hands, e.g., when both the common people and those of the better class wish the best men to rule. For thus and thus alone do all get what they aim at. Unanimity seems, then, to be political friendship, as indeed it is commonly said to be, for it is concerned with things that are to our interest and have an influence on our life. Now such unanimity is found among good men, for they are unanimous both in themselves and with one another, being, so to say, of one mind. For the wishes of such men are constant and not at the mercy of opposing currents like a strait of the sea. And they wish for what is just and what is advantageous. And these are the objects of their common endeavour as well. But bad men cannot be unanimous except to a small extent, any more than they can be friends, since they aim at getting more than their share of advantages, while in labour and public service they fall short of their share, and each man, wishing for advantage to himself, criticises his neighbour and stands in his way, for if people do not watch it carefully, the common weal is soon destroyed. The result is that they are in a state of faction, putting compulsion on each other, but unwilling themselves to do what is just. 7. Benefactors are thought to love those they have benefited more than those who have been well treated love those that have treated them well, and this is discussed as though it were paradoxical. Most people think it is because the latter are in a position of debtors and the former of creditors, and therefore, as in the case of loans, debtors wish their creditors did not exist, while creditors actually take care of the safety of their debtors, so it is thought that benefactors wish the objects of their action to exist, since they will then get their gratitude, while the beneficiaries take no interest in making this return. Epicharmus would perhaps declare that they say this because they look at things on their bad side. But it is quite like human nature, for most people are forgetful, and are more anxious to be well treated than to treat others well. But the cause would seem to be more deeply rooted in the nature of things. The case of those who have lent money is not even analogous, for they have no friendly feeling to their debtors, but only a wish that they may be kept safe with a view to what is to be got from them. While those who have done a service to others feel friendship and love for those they have served, even if these are not of any use to them and never will be. This is what happens with craftsmen too. Every man loves his own handiwork better than he would be loved by it if it came alive. And this happens perhaps most of all with the poets, for they have an excessive love for their own poems, doting on them as if they were their children. This is what the position of benefactors is like, for that which they have treated well is their handiwork, and therefore they love this more than the handiwork does its maker. The cause of this is that existence is to all men a thing to be chosen and loved, and that we exist by virtue of activity, i.e., by living and acting, and that the handiwork is in a sense the producer in activity. He loves his handiwork, therefore, because he loves existence, and this is rooted in the nature of things. For what he is in potentiality, his handiwork manifests in activity. At the same time, to the benefactor that is noble, which depends on his action, so that he delights in the object of his action, whereas to the patient, there is nothing noble in the agent, but at most, something advantageous, and this is less pleasant and lovable. What is pleasant is the activity of the present, the hope of the future, the memory of the past. But most pleasant is that which depends on activity. And similarly, this is most lovable. Now for a man who has made something, his work remains, for the noble is lasting, but for the person acted on, the utility passes away. And the memory of noble things is pleasant, but that of useful things is not likely to be pleasant, or is less so, though the reverse seems true of expectation. Further, love is like activity, being loved like passivity, and loving and its concomitants are attributes of those who are the more active. Again, all men love more what they have won by labour, e.g. those who have made their money love it more than those who have inherited it, and to be well treated seems to involve no labour, while to treat others well is a laborious task. These are the reasons, too, why mothers are fonder of their children than fathers. Bringing them into the world costs them more pains, and they know better that the children are their own. This last point, too, would seem to apply to benefactors. 8. The question is also debated whether a man should love himself most or someone else. People criticize those who love themselves most and call them self-lovers, using this as an epithet of disgrace. And a bad man seems to do everything for his own sake, and the more so, the more wicked he is, and so men reproach him, for instance, with doing nothing of his own accord, while the good man acts for honour's sake, and the more so, the better he is, and acts for his friend's sake, and sacrifices his own interest. But the facts clash with these arguments, and this is not surprising. For men say that one ought to love best one's best friend, and man's best friend is one who wishes well to the object of his wish for his sake, even if no one is to know of it. And these attributes are found most of all in a man's attitude towards himself. And so are all the other attributes by which a friend is defined, for, as we have said, it is from this relation that all the characteristics of friendship have extended to our neighbours. All the proverbs, too, agree with this, e.g., a single soul, and what friends have is common property, and friendship is equality, and charity begins at home. For all these marks will be found most in a man's relation to himself. He is his own best friend, and therefore ought to love himself best. It is therefore a reasonable question which of the two views we should follow, for both are plausible. Perhaps we ought to mark off such arguments from each other and determine how far and in what respects each view is right. Now, if we grasp the sense in which each school uses the phrase lover of self, the truth may become evident. Those who use the term as one of reproach ascribe self-love to people who assign to themselves the greater share of wealth, honours, and bodily pleasures, for these are what most people desire and busy themselves about as though they were the best of all things, which is the reason, too, why they become objects of competition. So those who are grasping with regard to these things gratify their appetites and in general their feelings and the irrational elements of the soul, and most men are of this nature, which is the reason why the epithet has come to be used as it is. It takes its meaning from the prevailing type of self-love, which is a bad one. It is just, therefore, that men who are lovers of self in this way are reproached for being so. That it is those who give themselves the preference in regard to objects of this sort that most people usually call lovers of self is plain. For if a man were always anxious that he himself, above all things, should act justly, temperately, or in accordance with any other of the virtues, and in general were always to try to secure for himself the honourable course, no one will call such a man a lover of self or blame him. But such a man would seem more than the other a lover of self. At all events, he assigns to himself the things that are noblest and best, and gratifies the most authoritative element in and in all things obeys this, and just as a city or any other systematic whole is most properly identified with the most authoritative element in it, so is a man. And therefore, the man who loves this and gratifies it is most of all a lover of self. Besides, a man is said to have or not to have self-control according as his reason has or has not the control, on the assumption that this is the man himself, and the things men have done on a rational principle are thought most properly their own acts and voluntary acts. That this is the man himself, then, or is so more than anything else, is plain, and also that the good man loves most this part of him. Whence it follows that he is most truly a lover of self, of another type, than that which is a matter of reproach, and as different from that as living according to a rational principle is from living as passion dictates, and desiring what is noble from desiring what seems advantageous. Those, then, who busy themselves in an exceptional degree with noble actions all men approve and praise, and if all were to strive towards what is noble and strain every nerve to do the noblest deeds, everything would be as it should be for the common weal, and everyone would secure for himself the goods that are greatest, since virtue is the greatest of goods. Therefore, the good man should be a lover of self, for he will both himself profit by doing noble acts, and will benefit his fellows. But the wicked man should not, for he will hurt both himself and his neighbours, following, as he does, evil passions. For the wicked man, what he does clashes with what he ought to do. But what the good man ought to do, he does. For reason, in each of its possessors, chooses what is best for itself, and the good man obeys his reason. It is true of the good man, too, that he does many acts for the sake of his friends and his country, and, if necessary, dies for them. For he will throw away both wealth and honours and in general the goods that are objects of competition, gaining for himself nobility, since he would prefer a short period of intense pleasure to a long one of mild enjoyment, a 12-month of noble life to many years of humdrum existence, and one great and noble action to many trivial ones. Now those who die for others doubtless attain this result. It is therefore a great prize that they choose for themselves. They will throw away wealth, too, on condition that their friends will gain more. For while a man's friend gains wealth, he himself achieves nobility. He is therefore assigning the greater good to himself. The same, too, is true of honour and office. All these things he will sacrifice to his friend, for this is noble and laudable for himself. Rightly, then, is he thought to be good, since he chooses nobility before all else. But he may even give up actions to his friend. It may be nobler to become the cause of his friend's acting than to act himself. In all the actions, therefore, that men are praised for, the good man is seen to assign to himself the greater share in what is noble. In this sense, then, as has been said, a man should be a lover of self, but in the sense in which most men are so, he ought not. 9. It is also disputed whether the happy man will need friends or not. It is said that those who are supremely happy and self-sufficient have no need of friends, for they have the things that are good, and therefore, being self-sufficient, they need nothing further, while a friend, being another self, furnishes what a man cannot provide by his own effort, whence the saying, "When fortune is kind, what need of friends?" But it seems strange, when one assigns all good things to the happy man, not to assign friends who are thought the greatest of external goods. And if it is more characteristic of a friend to do well by another than to be well done by, and to confer benefits is characteristic of the good man and of virtue, and it is nobler to do well by friends than by strangers, the good man will need people to do well by. This is why the question is asked, whether we need friends more in prosperity or in adversity, on the assumption that not only does a man in adversity need people to confer benefits on him, but also those who are prospering need people to do well by. Surely it is strange, too, to make the supremely happy man a solitary. For no one would choose the whole world on condition of being alone, since man is a political creature, and one whose nature is to live with others. Therefore, even the happy man lives with others, for he has the things that are by nature good. And plainly it is better to spend his days with friends and good men than with strangers or any chance persons. Therefore the happy man needs friends. What then is it that the first school means, and in what respect is it right? Is it that most identify friends with useful people? Of such friends indeed the supremely happy man will have no need, since he already has the things that are good, nor will he need those whom one makes one's friends because of their pleasantness, or he will need them only to a small extent, for his life, being pleasant, has no need of adventitious pleasure. And because he does not need such friends, he is thought not to need friends. But that is surely not true. For we have said at the outset that happiness is an activity, and activity plainly comes into being and is not present at the start like a piece of property, if, first, happiness lies in living and being active, and the good man's activity is virtuous and pleasant in itself, as we have said at the outset, and second, a thing's being one's own is one of the attributes that make it pleasant, and third, we can contemplate our neighbours better than ourselves and their actions better than our own, and if the actions of virtuous men, who are their friends, are pleasant to good men, since these have both the attributes that are naturally pleasant, if this be so, the supremely happy man will need friends of this sort, since his purpose is to contemplate worthy actions and actions that are his own, and the actions of a good man who is his friend have both these qualities. Further, men think that the happy man ought to live pleasantly. Now, if he were a solitary, life would be hard for him. For by oneself it is not easy to be continuously active, but with others and towards others it is easier. With others, therefore, his activity will be more continuous, and it is in itself pleasant, as it ought to be for the man who is supremely happy. For a good man, qua good, delights in virtuous actions and is vexed at vicious ones, as a musical man enjoys beautiful tunes but is pained at bad ones. A certain training in virtue arises also from the company of the good, as Theonis has said before us. If we look deeper into the nature of things, a virtuous friend seems to be naturally desirable for a virtuous man. For that which is good by nature, we have said, is for the virtuous man good and pleasant in itself. Now life is defined in the case of animals by the power of perception, in that of man by the power of perception or thought, and a power is defined by reference to the corresponding activity, which is the essential thing. Therefore, life seems to be essentially the act of perceiving or thinking, and life is among the things that are good and pleasant in themselves, since it is determinate, and the determinate is of the nature of the good, and that which is good by nature is also good for the virtuous man, which is the reason why life seems pleasant to all men. But we must not apply this to a wicked and corrupt life, nor to a life spent in pain, for such a life is indeterminate, as are its attributes. The nature of pain will become plainer in what follows. But if life itself is good and pleasant, which it seems to be from the very fact that all men desire it, and particularly those who are good and supremely happy, for to such men life is most desirable, and their existence is the most supremely happy. And if he who sees perceives that he sees, and he who hears that he hears, and he who walks that he walks, and in the case of all other activities similarly, there is something which perceives that we are active, so that if we perceive, we perceive that we perceive, and if we think that we think. And if to perceive that we perceive or think is to perceive that we exist. For existence was defined as perceiving or thinking. And if perceiving that one lives is in itself one of the things that are pleasant, for life is by nature good, and to perceive what is good present in oneself is pleasant, and if life is desirable, and particularly so for good men, because to them existence is good and pleasant, for they are pleased at the consciousness of the presence in them of what is in itself good, and if, as the virtuous man is to himself, he is to his friend also, for his friend is another self, if all this be true, as his own being is desirable for each man, so, or almost so, is that of his friend. Now his being was seen to be desirable because he perceived his own goodness, and such perception is pleasant in itself. He needs therefore to be conscious of the existence of his friend as well, and this will be realized in their living together and sharing in discussion and thought, for this is what living together would seem to mean in the case of man, and not, as in the case of cattle, feeding in the same place. If, then, being is in itself desirable for the supremely happy man, since it is by its nature good and pleasant, and that of his friend is very much the same, a friend will be one of the things that are desirable. Now that which is desirable for him he must have, or he will be deficient in this respect. The man who is to be happy will therefore need virtuous friends. 10. Should we, then, make as many friends as possible, or, as in the case of hospitality, it is thought to be suitable advice that one should be neither a man of many guests, nor a man with none? Will that apply to friendship as well? Should a man neither be friendless, nor have an excessive number of friends? To friends made with a view to utility, this saying would seem thoroughly applicable. For to do services to many people in return is a laborious task, and life is not long enough for its performance. Therefore, friends in excess of those who are sufficient for our own life are superfluous and hindrances to the noble life, so that we have no need of them. Of friends made with a view to pleasure also, few are enough, as a little seasoning in food is enough. But as regards good friends, should we have as many as possible, or is there a limit to the number of one's friends as there is to the size of a city? You cannot make a city of 10 men, and if there are 100,000, it is a city no longer. But the proper number is presumably not a single number, but anything that falls between certain fixed points. So for friends too, there is a fixed number, perhaps the largest number, with whom one can live together. For that, we found, thought to be very characteristic of friendship. And that one cannot live with many people and divide oneself up among them is plain. Further, they too must be friends of one another, if they are all to spend their days together. And it is a hard business for this condition to be fulfilled with a large number. It is found difficult, too, to rejoice and to grieve in an intimate way with many people. For it may likely happen that one has at once to be happy with one friend and to mourn with another. Presumably, then, it is well not to seek to have as many friends as possible, but as many as are enough for the purpose of living together. For it would seem actually impossible to be a great friend to many people. This is why one cannot love several people. Love is ideally a sort of excess of friendship, and that can only be felt towards one person. Therefore, great friendship, too, can only be felt towards a few people. This seems to be confirmed in practice. For we do not find many people who are friends in the comradely way of friendship, and the famous friendships of this sort are always between two people. Those who have many friends and mix intimately with them all are thought to be no one's friend except in the way proper to fellow citizens, and such people are also called obsequious. In the way proper to fellow citizens, indeed, it is possible to be the friend of many, and yet not be obsequious, but a genuinely good man. But one cannot have with many people the friendship based on virtue and on the character of our friends themselves, and we must be content if we find even a few such. 11. Do we need friends more in good fortune or in bad? They are sought after in both. For while men in adversity need help, in prosperity they need people to live with and to make the objects of their beneficence. For they wish to do well by others. Friendship, then, is more necessary in bad fortune. And so it is useful friends that one wants in this case. But it is more noble in good fortune, and so we also seek for good men as our friends, since it is more desirable to confer benefits on these and to live with these. For the very presence of friends is pleasant both in good fortune and also in bad, since grief is lightened when friends sorrow with us. Hence one might ask whether they share, as it were, our burden, or, without that happening, their presence by its pleasantness, and the thought of their grieving with us make our pain less. Whether it is for these reasons, or for some other, that our grief is lightened, is a question that may be dismissed. At all events, what we have described appears to take place. But their presence seems to contain a mixture of various factors. The very seeing of one's friends is pleasant, especially if one is in adversity, and becomes a safeguard against grief, for a friend tends to comfort us both by the sight of him and by his words, if he is tactful, since he knows our character and the things that please or pain us. But to see him pained at our misfortunes is painful, for everyone shuns being a cause of pain to his friends. For this reason, people of a manly nature guard against making their friends grieve with them, and, unless he be exceptionally insensible to pain, such a man cannot stand the pain that ensues for his friends, and in general does not admit fellow mourners because he is not himself given to mourning. But women and womanly men enjoy sympathizers in their grief, and love them as friends and companions in sorrow. But in all things one obviously ought to imitate the better type of person. On the other hand, the presence of friends in our prosperity implies both a pleasant passing of our time and the pleasant thought of their pleasure at our own good fortune. For this cause it would seem that we ought to summon our friends readily to share our good fortunes, for the beneficent character is a noble one. But summon them to our bad fortunes with hesitation. For we ought to give them as little a share as possible in our evils, whence the saying, "Enough is my misfortune." We should summon friends to us most of all when they are likely by suffering a few inconveniences to do us a great service. Conversely, it is fitting to go unasked and readily to the aid of those in adversity, for it is characteristic of a friend to render services, and especially to those who are in need and have not demanded them. Such action is nobler and pleasanter for both persons. But when our friends are prosperous, we should join readily in their activities, for they need friends for these too, but be tardy in coming forward to be the objects of their kindness, for it is not noble to be keen to receive benefits. Still, we must no doubt avoid getting the reputation of killjoys by repulsing them, for that sometimes happens. The presence of friends, then, seems desirable in all circumstances. 12. Does it not follow, then, that, as for lovers, the sight of the beloved is the thing they love most, and they prefer this sense to the others because on it love depends most for its being and for its origin, so for friends, the most desirable thing